Accession number 16628, Reel 2.
Mr. Clubley, Reel 2. I just asked you if you remembered any specific incidents in the Falaise operations.
Yes, in the few days I was there for it, it was exciting because it was a matter of how quickly could you get back, rearm, refuel, and get back to it. And, of course, there were aircraft from all airfields round about. So it was quite exciting, but I think that was probably the end of the hectic phase in Normandy, because the army were on the move then, and we were army support, of course, and it was a question of waiting until they stabilised a bit and we moved forward to get in a suitable position to support them.
Was it mainly tanks you were after?
It was mainly tanks, and mainly tanks and personnel carriers, getting the army people out. And I can recall one or two incidents of tanks trying to get out. You could see the people, the crews, and they were being slaughtered by rockets coming from all over the place. It really was quite horrific.
How did you feel about it? Did you feel any sense of compassion for them?
No. I don't know whether I'm unfeeling there, but this was our job, and they were doing that to their enemies. So at that time, I may say, going a lot farther forward, I eventually ended up in Germany after the war in peacetime, and I got on very well with the Germans. But this was different. We were fighting. And as far as we were concerned, they were the enemy, and the more of them we could knock out, the better.
What did you think would happen if you were shot down and captured by the people you were attacking?
I can't really recall even considering. It was one of these risks you took, and I don't think maybe I was lacking in imagination. I didn't think about it. One read about all sorts of horror stories, but you also read about people who were very well looked after, and I know quite a few of the people who were shot down were extremely well looked after. One of them I saw a couple of years back on our reunion, Billy Gray, with whom I shared a tent way back in Romney Marsh's time. He was shot down over Normandy, and the Germans put him into an ambulance, and off he went, it wasn't an ambulance, it was one of their armoured vehicles, which unfortunately was attacked by one of our aircraft. And he was shot in the leg. And he's still lame. But the majority, you heard of the atrocities that went on, not of all the other side where they didn't go on. They were soldiers, the same as ourselves. Soldiers of Yemen.
And did you do any operations in Normandy which were very close to our own lines?
Oh, yes. This was one of the good points about rockets. You could attack very close to your own troops because they were very accurate. When I say very accurate, compared to bombs, not as accurate as guns, of course. But the army, we found, were gaining more and more confidence in rockets. They were very chary about air attack to begin with. Presumably they had bad experience been hit, but as time went on, they would call for targets just 100 yards on, and they were quite happy to let us attack them. We had quite a good relationship with them.
So rockets were less accurate than strafing with bullets?
Oh, with guns, yes. Could you aim straight at the target? With rockets, you still had to lay off a bit and allow for gravity drop and things like that. So. But they were a big improvement on the bombs.
And after the breakout, what happened to you then?
We sat. I can't honestly recall time. There was time when the level of our activity, of course, dropped because the targets were getting farther and farther away with the army, the German forces moving away. We went to one airfield, not far from Chartres, I remember we could see the cathedral, and we couldn't, by the time we got down there, we still couldn't reach the army, because it was still far. We moved up to Amiens, once they filled the holes in the runway, which the bomber command had pasted at various times, and we stopped there for only a matter of a week, I suppose, and did one or two operations from there, getting farther and farther away all the time. I can remember one on that day, tugging, it was purely army, trucks, personnel carriers, what have you, in full retreat. It really was an army in full retreat at that stage. And then, in due course, the guards moved into Brussels, and we moved up there, Brussels Malesbrook. I can't remember the date. September, I think it was, in Brussels Malesbrook.
It doesn't matter about the
exact
date.
Doesn't matter the date there, but
did the operations continue to be of the same character?
Yes, the distances involved were a bit greater, of course. We had been operating just a matter of a few miles from it, but as soon as the army started moving, the distance got quite long from Malesbrook, because we stayed in Malesbrook until Eindhoven was cleared, and that's quite a long way north.
Did you operate in support of Arnhem?
Yes. And I must say, not as much as we had hoped we'd be. Personally, I still feel we could have done, if the army had been willing to call us in, we could have done a lot more for Market Garden. We did, I can recall, one or two operations trying to clear the road so that the guards, reinforcements could get up there. But we weren't called on very much. I don't know quite why.
What were losses like by now to the squadron?
Oh, they were very much reduced. Very much reduced now. There wasn't so much of the close support. Once we got to Arnhem, to Eindhoven, and the German army had gone over the Rhine almost by then, and we were back into the interdiction role, not attacking the army so much, but attacking trains, support, supplies, anything that was coming in. We were going over the Rhine, and that carried on until I was told by Commander Kit North Lewis that I was too expired.
So what happened to you then?
By that time I had done 145 operations, which I thought was a fair number. And it's strange how that thing happened. My CO at the end, a man called Barraclough, was a very keen gunnery man, and he said, your thing to do is to go and do gunnery now, because you've done so much of it during the thing. So I went to Catros and did the pilot attack instructor's course.
And this is the East Riding, I should say.
The East Riding part, yes.
Now we're into Spring 45.
Spring 45, yes.
You changed from one squadron to another?
Yes. Sorry, I've skipped, haven't I? Because come the 1st of January, come the 31st of December 44, Wing Commander Flying told me I was going over to 137 to take over the flight, because my predecessor there was still expired, Pete Tickner, whom I met the other day. So I went over to 137 Squadron, which had joined our wing a little later, towards the end of Normandy they came over. Until then we had been three squadrons. 181, 182, and 247 had been our wing, and then 139 joined us. And I spent only 3 months with them. But of course, my first operation with them, was on the 1st of January, 45, the time of the German sortie.
This was the so-called German Air Force's last fling.
Last fling.
What happened to you on that day?
Well, I was airborne, actually, so we thought there was a lot of activity around. Firstly, we were bounced by an American P-38 Lightning, who had decided we looked rather like an enemy aircraft. So we had to chase him off. And then we saw, I'm trying to remember the number and name of the aircraft, the German twin-engine jet, which they had been experimenting with. We saw one of those, and we thought this would be interesting, but of course he had a little more speed than we had. He just left us standing. We were just going over the Rhine. And we went and did our usual searching of railway lines, trains, anything that looked like the army moving on the air on the German side. Came back home and called up base and were told, don't come here, go to can't remember the name of it, our sister airfield, which was about 20 miles north of ours. So we landed there to be told that our airfield was pretty battered, Eindhoven. So we stayed there, and I phoned Kip North Lewis, who told me about the raid, and told me to stay there. We stayed there overnight and went back to Eindhoven the following day, and there was a mess, but they cleared most of it up before then, before we got there. So I missed out on, well, I was in the best place. I was airborne. We saw a few aircraft, you know, which rang a little bell. We couldn't think why, because nobody told us anything while we were airborne. But no one made any attempt to attack us. We were obviously briefed for the ground attack.
How much did it affect morale?
I don't think it affected morale at all. It surprised people. But I wasn't conscious of any running down the morale at all. In fact, I think the opposite, that there must be more aircraft around there and more forces around there, and let's get that to my dear. But we didn't see much of them. We were never really troubled by enemy aircraft. Going back to Spitfire, and by the time we got to Normandy, there were very few aircraft around, German aircraft around. And there were so many Spitfires who had the role of keeping the enemy away, attacking anything. If one German aircraft turned up, there would be a couple of Spitfire squadrons all chasing this one aircraft. There was a shortage of German aircraft as far as the Spitfires was concerned, so we were never troubled with them. Only once did we get a 190 flying over the field, firing his guns, but I don't think he was very serious. He was just trying to get out of the way.
When the losses were occurring earlier in the Northwest Europe campaign, had that affected morale much?
No. Not to my anything which I was aware. We were all tense when you went on operations, but it became a way of life. You were sorry when somebody got shot down and just hoped it wasn't you next time, my dear, but it didn't really, it didn't brood on it.
Did you ever come across this phenomenon of lack of moral fiber?
Yes, I must admit. Once or twice, not to any great extent. One I came across, we had a pilot join the squadron, this was in 137 days, in Eindhoven, at the time of the Arnhem, just after Arnhem, and he was, I won't mention any names, he was very tense, obviously, and I took him as my number two. I was leading the squadron. And we dove down, and I was conscious of his rockets passing me, which shouldn't have happened, because they shouldn't fire until I had fired. I was the nearest to the target, so I judged the thing. And I looked around for him, and he had already fired all his rockets and was climbing like mad. He was way above us. So I had words with him, get back. And he was shaking. He really was. And he was slightly older, quite an experienced pilot. He'd have been a flying instructor and came onto the squadron a little late. And he really was over the top. So it was nerves. This lack of Model 5 is a term that came out later, I think. We just took it that tour expired, they'd done enough, so he didn't stay on the squadron. We couldn't keep him.
Was he removed after that?
Yes. He went back under strike. He was a very fine pilot, actually. But it was just, I suppose he could just put it down to fear. And one or two of... I've come across one or two people who spent more time counting out how many operations they had done and how soon would the tour expire, which was an early sign that they were obviously under tension. Fortunately, by this time, there were sufficient surplus pilots around that you didn't have to persist with them. And they were quietly moved out. I think it depended on the nature of the person more than anything. If they were imaginative, and I've never had a great imagination, if you're imaginative, I think you could probably think of all the things that might happen to you, and it worried. But not to any great extent. You could get tour expired people who are getting towards the end of the tour, and the early signs would be probably a little more drinking than they were normally doing, and you could see a little shake coming in every now and again. But I take my hat off to people like Kit Northluce, who used to watch very carefully and whistle people out when they felt that they had enough, particularly as you could see the end of the war coming up. I think it probably came on more then, because people were foreseeing that the worst was over. They didn't want to be caught then.
Was it done discreetly, or were they punished?
Oh, yes. No, done discreetly. A lot of them had done a lot of good work for over a long period. And I think it was just nerves were catching up on them, which I think it was a very understandable thing. Others, I suppose you could say, it must have been a terribly difficult thing to assess whether someone was going to suffer from that sort of behaviour before he had actually experienced it. You know, you couldn't foresee it. Some perfectly normal, some great big strapping chaps, some very well balanced. It was a complete cross section. You never really knew. I don't think there was anything external. You had to just wait and see. And it was I think if it did actually happen, it was a criticism of the hierarchy more than the individual. Somebody hadn't been watching. As long as you kept an eye on people, you could stop it. And my experience of it being tour expired was, I think, done the ideal way. I wanted to see the end of the war, you know, carry right on. Got all the way from Normandy to... We were just coming up the Rhine crossing, March 45. And I came back from an operation. And Kit Northluce was there, and he said, "Did you enjoy your last trip?" This was the first... I hadn't even thought of it until then, and that was the last trip. That, is the ideal way to do it. The American way of seeing, you know, 50 operations or 20 operations or whatever they did, I think was terrible, because there were... You know, counting it off. And the number of losses that happened right at the end of their tour was quite horrific, and I think this was probably due to nerves.
How did the brother pilots react if somebody was showing signs of cracking?
If it was noticed early enough, a quiet word to the flight commander or the CO. Would stop it becoming too widespread. I don't really recall anyone, certainly somebody wouldn't be there, and you hadn't really, unless you were close to him, you weren't really aware of it. But word quickly spread. If anyone noticed anything like that, he would tell somebody else and tell somebody else, and word would get around and the chap would, he would vanish. I don't recall anyone, but of course I wouldn't necessarily know this, coming forward himself and saying, I've had it. I suppose this was pride, but it might have happened. But I think by the time it had struck them, they were probably past that stage of admitting it.
But did anybody ever pass cruel remarks about him?
Not to my knowledge. No, I never came across that. I never came across that at all. Our squadrons had we had a very good squadron spirit there, and I think they would do anything to protect their mates. And if there had been anything like that, I think it would have been mentioned early enough for action to be taken before it became noticeable.
Any particular VE Day memories?
VE Day, where was I VE Day?
Were you at Cat Falls?
No, I wasn't. I was on leave in South Shields. I think, yes, leave in South Shields. I remember BJ Day as well. I was at where was it? At our own practice camp, just started in just north of South End. We had started an armament practice camp. It was the end of Bradwell Bay, and VJ Day was then, but the war was long over by then. I was then on as a gunnery instructor at Armand practice camp.
After the war, you did a lot of work on nuclear weapons. What did that consist of?
Yes, later on. That happened, I think, because I'd got involved in the weapons world. I think I mentioned earlier on my squadron commander on 137 was a keen gunnery man and suggested that I should go and do some more gunnery when I left the squadron. And obviously relayed this to fighter command, who sent me to Catfoss to do the gunnery course, from where I went on to Armand practice camps and was there for 3 years. Giving gunnery instruction to rotating squadrons. You know, this was in that phase after the war when no one was quite sure what was going to happen. And the Amnesty set up a weapons course in which people would do a course on all sorts of weapons, become general, not just fighter pilots and bomb pilots, just weapons. So we went to Manby. I did a course in which we did air gunnery in Lancaster, which was quite an experience for me, fighter fans, as you can imagine, front gun, rear gun. I did bombing in Lancasters, and then the next day we'd be flying Spitfires, attacking the bombing while our fellow mates were in the turret. It was quite good fun. Learning everything we could about weapons. From there, I was sent to Canada to do 2 years exchange posting with the Canadian Air Force at their Air Armament School. Again, teaching, well, new pilots the gunnery. I came back from there and inevitably, as I had been flying, sent to an admin job. I became an adjutant at Leeming, where I was for something like 3 months, when someone in the Air Ministry found that I was a weapons qualified man. So I was pulled off that and sent to Fort Holston in Kent, which was the HER, High Explosive Research Establishment, under Professor Penny. Became Lord Penny. He was running at the time, and this was the build-up to our first Blue Danube, first atomic bomb. And we were charged with. There was a little team of us learning about the bomb, and I was air crew, so my task was learning the effects of the bomb. And the others, there was a signal man down in the electronics and the electrics on it, and an armor and people, like, you know, cross section of us, little team. And we spent a year there, during which time they exploded the first British one at Montebello. And some of the team, half of the team, went out there and were involved in that.
Did you go out?
No, I didn't go out. I was writing on effects. We were writing a book on the effects. And,
from the RAF point of view?
From the RAF point of view, yes.
What kind of effect?
The effect of nuclear explosions on targets, because we did a lot of target study when I was on the MAMBI course. And we had a lot of American books, their idea. They had been doing the same, of course, and working out what effect this would have on our aircraft, on Bomber Command abilities.
What was the effect on targets?
Well, it was a bit different from dropping the 1,000-pounders with this huge weapon that they had, 20-kiloton. And they were having to review their tactics to dropping this thing and getting out of the way very quickly. These were the sort of things we were working out, and also what was happening on the ground. And if, having spent a year at HER, at Fort Halstead, studying, we went up to RAF Wittering and founded the Bomber Command Armament School, in which we ran courses on it, on the bomb. And I was there for a few years, 2 years. Yes. And then on to the Air Ministry on bomber operations, which was quite a change round for me, having been fighters all my life.